This is an ABC podcast.
Hamrana Kelly, Dairopoa and good follow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Nemblomi Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong. I'm the ABC reporter here in my home country, Solomon Islands, and I'm part of the Pacific Journalism Network, where we bring you Pacific Beat each Friday live from our very own countries. That's from PNG, Tonga and Fiji. Today on the show, questions over Solomon Islands sovereignty as Cabinet weighs up whether to let Taiwanese officials attend the Pacific Islands Forum. Fears this week that the International Court of Justice verdict could have serious implications on Pacific nations' relations with Australia.
Now we can really hold states accountable if they are not doing enough.
And Solomon Islands women's captain opens up on the side's historic win at the OFC Nations Cup.
It's just all tears of joy, you know, like looking, coming back and see our families and the supporters. It's just emotionally.
That and more coming up. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong, and you're tuning in to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin in Fiji, where Fijian-born recording artist and Pacific music legend George Fiji Veikoso has died at the age of 55 in Suva. Best known for shaping the sound of Polynesian reggae and island R&B, Veikoso spent more than 30 years in Hawaii, where his music career took off and earned him global fame. It was only last year that he returned to Fiji for his first ever homecoming concert, a sold-out event in Nandi that drew thousands of fans from across the Pacific. Chair of the Fiji Performing Rights Association and Fiji music legend Laisa Vulakoro says Veikoso was the biggest star to come out of the Pacific.
I'm very, very sad. Very sad about this news. We weren't expecting it or anything like this. And I haven't seen him since homecoming last year. And I'm really sad. I mean, he's the biggest artist ever came out of Fiji and the Pacific. You know, he's made Fiji proud. He put his name as Fiji. And it's a great loss. It's a really big loss for all of us. Here at FIPRA, I know we're all sad. We're all gathering here and just in his memory, sitting around Mesa, Wuto, Vili, Epi, a few other members, thinking of him. Yeah, I'm really sad today. It's a great loss for Fiji and Fiji music industry.
Ms. Vulakoro, what did George Veikoso's music mean for the Fiji music brand?
He really started something very distinctive, you know, the way he combined Fijian music into reggae and maintaining the traditional themes, you know, of bunde and chants and all that. He took Fiji music to another level, you know. I'm sorry, I'm crying because I'm really sad. I'm really sad. And, you know, he was an amazing, amazing, talented human being. That's what I can tell you. He took Fijian music to another level. And we all kind of emulate him. You know? He's like our idol. He's my biggest idol. You know, I'm so sad that he's passed.
That was the chair of the Fiji Performing Rights Association, Laisa Vulakoro. And for more on this story, we cross now to our reporter in Fiji, Lide Movono. With that, I say, Yandravina Alide.
Yandravina, Chrissy, good to be talking to you again, but not so great to be talking about the death of a legend.
Yes, indeed, not so great news this morning for Pacific and music lovers as well. But how's the news of the death of popular musician George Fiji Veikoso being felt there in Fiji?
Chrissy, it's being felt quite deeply, not just in Fiji. We can't lay claim to the legend anymore. He really was someone that all across the region, people could lay claim to. His music, his art, his words, but also just the intentional way that he worked with artists all across every Pacific Island country meant that the man closed the chapter yesterday that everyone in the Pacific can lay claim to. People have described him as the most prolific singer-songwriter and producer from the region, accredited with over 100 songs. It was solo albums. It was collaborations with also the Pacific's best. So people are super sad here, Chrissy. He wasn't just a musician. To Fijians, to hear in Viti, he was a movement. The fact that he died at an age that many consider quite young has triggered a huge outpouring of grief. There are music fans, there are artists from across Pacific culture and Fijian culture. There are Pacific sports teams and political leaders and everyone that had any kind of even remote link to the Pacific. They're paying tributes, and it's coming by the minute from Hawaii, from Aotearoa, from Samoa, Tonga, everywhere. People are calling him the greatest of all time. And the thing about this goat, Chrissy, is that the biggest, wherever you turn in the Pacific, every big artist there is has been helped by him, mentored by him in some way, and they all describe him as a big brother or a cultural giant. But in Fiji, in Raiwanga, the neighborhood where he grew up, people are playing his music. They're celebrating memories, they're sharing memories, and they're just celebrating the fact that this was a Fijian man that lifted Fiji. He intentionally put the name of the country in his name. And if I can paraphrase what he said he just wanted to be remembered as George, but he wanted his work to make people remember Fiji always.
He certainly did that through his music as well, not only for the new generation, but the old generation. He left Fiji many decades ago, Lee, there, and moved to Hawaii, where he made a name for himself. But was he still well known in his homeland?
Absolutely. George Vicoso, you know, moved to Hawaii in 1987, so, you know, more than 30 years ago. But Fiji remained quite central to his identity, and he was intentional and quite strategic about that. Make no mistake, I mean, the man was a prolific, legendary artist, but he was also a shrewd businessman, if I can call it that. He intentionally put the name Fiji in his name and in his music and in his messages. And once he got that brand down pat, it was really hard to say George Vekoso and not think about Fiji. And so he carried the country, our identity, our stories with him. But more so, once he got that out of the way and the brand locked in stone, he did that for Samoa, for Tonga, and for many other countries across the Pacific. But in Fiji, people will remember him most because he was raised in Raiwanga, one of Suva's most resilient neighborhood, and that upbringing gave him an edge, and it gave him an authenticity that made his music quite distinct. And despite living abroad, he never forgot that. He took Raiwanga with him, and people, you know, kind of resonated with it because those universal values that he sang about was common all around the world. And so he was never forgotten at home, but he was really building stories about Fiji wherever he went, on buses, on radio, in everywhere in Fiji. No one can go past music and not talk about George Fiji Vekoso. But he cemented his legendary status when he came back last year and brought back that homecoming brand concert, which sold out not just the Fijians. People came from all over the Pacific and around the world to come. Chrissy, I'd never seen anything like that, where Nandi, our tourist hub, was just absolutely without accommodation. You could not find a place to sleep because everyone in the world came to watch that man. And even as he dealt with illness, he kept showing up for Fiji, so Fiji lay claim to him.
Yes, and he certainly carried Fiji also in his name, and as we continue to see tributes flowing in from across the Pacific. But what's his influence been on modern Fiji culturally there?
I think in terms of modern Fiji culture, one of the quotes that stayed with me last night as I poured through all of the tributes came through, you know, one of Fiji's most notable public figures, John Apted, who said his music, he was thanking George Vicoso overnight for the music. And he said, thank you for the music of our lives. And I think that really aptly described what George Vicoso's music was like. It was the life of every Fiji. But, you know, we have to acknowledge the fact that it became the life of every Pacific Islander, the music that he made. But when you speak about it technically, I think Laisa Volokoro, who herself is a gifted, iconic Fijian musician, she described it really well when she said, he built a brand. He took authentic Fijian sounds and authentic Fijian cultural concepts, and he built it into a new genre of music. And, you know, he was a genre-defying artist in that he created a sound that now, 30 years on, you can't really go into the Pacific without understanding that this is the music of the Pacific. It's a little bit of reggae, soul, and also R&B, but it's a music that people in Fiji can identify with as being their sound, as being their identity. But Chrissy, I also must talk about the fact that he was a gifted lyricist. And I think that was my favorite personal thing about him, is his words, the way he used the gift of lyricism to tell stories about real life in, you know, newly independent Fiji, about poverty, about struggle, about growing up in a home without a father. But he created that kind of music and messaging that transcended race. It transcended class, it transcended gender, and it became the music that all of us could reflect on, whatever, you know, part of life you were going through. So he captured that so beautifully and in such a complex and wonderful way that Laisa Volokoro said to me, he took Fiji music to another level, and that influence is going to be alive in the voices of Fijian music for a very long time, Chrissy.
Certainly, it will be alive in the music and across the Pacific. Many will always remember who George Fiji Vekoso was. But I wonder how will he be remembered there in Fiji?
I think right now people are still in shock. There's a lot of grief. I mean, I think I'm doing a very good job not falling apart on air while I'm talking about him with you. But people will remember him as the greatest. He really was the greatest. He did stand on the shoulders of so many giants, wonderful musicians who, you know, carried his work and who carried his talent and who gave him the space. But he will be remembered as not just as Fiji's greatest. He will be remembered as the Pacific's greatest. And we're seeing that from Pacific Islanders already giving tributes and paying homage to the man that a lot of them call their mentor or Uncle George, someone that gave them the space to be great themselves. But in terms of his actual accolades, I struggled overnight to find, you know, a number, the number of works that the man made. And there isn't a specific number anywhere, but I read that more than 100 tracks can be attributed to him in some way. So he was either, you know, the singular artist on it, or he produced it, or he, you know, let people take a part of him into the tracks. And for his genius, he won, you know, Male Vocalist of the Year and Favorite Entertainer of the Year at the Hawaii's Nahoku Hanohano Awards. He won Pacific Music Awards in Aotearoa. He won Lifetime Achievement Awards in Fiji. He kept being brought back as, you know, Fiji's lifetime greatest at the FIPRA Music Awards. But also one or two of his works has also been Grammy nominated back in 2002, and works that he's done with huge artists like Jay Boog, for example, would later earn them Grammy nods too. And so his music is going to stay on for a while. But Chrissy, beyond the trophy, George Vicoso's legacy is personal. He mentored countless artists. I tried to do a count last night, but couldn't come up with a number. He opened doors for Pacific musicians in the US, and he carried our voices to the world. He sang in our language, and he sang with our identity and our heart. And even when he was unwell, he still sang from a wheelchair even, and because of the people and the music that mattered so much to him. So Chrissy, legends never die. They live on in the voices they inspire.
They live on. Yes, George Fijive Koso, Uncle George, like you mentioned, or Podgy, all his music will never be forgotten. Live Movono, thank you so much for your time. Vinava Levu. Pacific Beat. Good follow morning and welcome back. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong, coming live to you here from Solomon Islands. And an opposition MP here in the country says that the country risks creating a wedge in the solidarity of the Pacific Islands Forum if it refuses to allow Taiwan to attend. According to local media, Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele last week said cabinet is yet to decide whether Taiwanese government representatives will be allowed into the country to attend the Forum Leaders Summit in Honiara this September. Taiwan has been a development partner of the forum since the 1990s, but the Solomons has cut all bilateral ties since it switched diplomatic allegiance to China in 2019. Now, earlier this year, Taiwanese officials were blocked from entering Honiara on a preparatory trip ahead of the Leaders' Summit, reportedly at the behest of China. Opposition MP Peter Kenny Laurier Jr. says these incidents and the ongoing uncertainty around Taiwan's attendance are shocking and raises questions about China's impact on the country's sovereignty. And to explain why, he joins us now. Good follow morning, Peter Kenny Laurier Jr. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Krishnita.
It's good to have you back on the show. Let's get straight into it. Now, in a social media post, you described the whole situation as deeply insulting and a slap in the face to Solomon Islands. Why is that?
Yes, I think there's two main points I was trying to make. Is that the first one was just the solidarity of the region. I think we need to look at the region as a collective, and also respecting the sovereignty of other countries that are members of the regional organization like the Pacific Islands Forum. And I think all member countries have a right to choose who their partners are. It's not for us to try and impose or try to be condescending, you know, in terms of who we think their partners should be, because I think that is what is happening here. And I think with a slap in the face of the sovereignty of Solomon Islands is the idea that we can't even get to choose who comes into our country. It's for us to decide that, who comes in or who doesn't come in. The report that this was done at the behest of China is really, really deeply insulting to our sovereignty as a nation.
So, Mr. Ken Laurier Jr., do you think Mr. Manele and his government should have any say over who attends the forum then?
Well, the forum is it's a regional meeting. The practices for attending of these meetings are done and agreed upon already. And the forum secretariat is the one that actually runs these meetings. I think as hosts, we are good hosts in terms of looking to facilitate everything, you know, to make sure that our visitors feel welcomed and participate freely in our country, and that the outcomes of these meetings reflect our efforts in doing that. So I think when it comes to these meetings, it's one that's done every year. And it's Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat that pretty much runs these meetings. So I think when it comes to who attends these meetings, I think there's already practice that's been set already, set in stone, really, because for the participation of development partners, including that of Taiwan, is one that's already been agreed to by leaders already previously, as you mentioned in the introductions.
Yes, and what's the risk for Solomon Islands, if I may ask, if Taiwan is prevented from attending the Forum Leaders Summit?
Well, I think for us, you know, in terms of the region, we might be seen as a country that's not really a good actor, you know, in terms of respecting forum leaders' decisions. So forum leaders' decisions have already been made. And to hear the Prime Minister, who is one of our top diplomats, a former diplomat, you know, saying that Solomon Islands cabinet is his cabinet is still deciding on participation of some in our country or an entity, if you're China, that has already been agreed to their participation to attend. It's really shocking in the sense that these are already decided upon, and that a cabinet of a nation is looking to even overturn that, and that is the shocking part of it. So I think Solomon Islands runs the risk of becoming, you know, not a reliable partner in the Pacific Islands Forum family.
And that's the risk for Solomon Islands. What about the risk for the Pacific Islands Forum if, say, Taiwan is blocked?
Yeah, so I think the risk for the region is that Solomon Islands might be contributing to being the wedge that would start to shake the solidarity of Pacific Islands Forum in a world that is becoming a one where of a major big power competition. And where might is right, you know, that sort of thing, and unilateral decisions are taken by big, strong countries. We need to be stronger together, collectively, and by doing this, we are running the risk of dividing the Pacific Islands Forum in a time when we really need to be the closest together, you know, to bind together. Because our strength is in our collective, our collective strength is where we are at, you know, in terms of trying to counter, and also making sure that our focus on issues that we deem to be important for us get the highest possible visibility around the world as well. So I think running the risk of a divided forum is something that Solomon Islands should be very careful of, you know, knowing full well as well that the next forum will also be in Palau, and that Palau is still an ally of Taiwan. And what happens then if Palau decides to do something? You know, I know Palau leaders perhaps think more about regional solidarity than Solomon Islands, and perhaps might not want to do what we're doing. That is up to them. But for us, Solomon Islands, you know, we should continue to promote solidarity, and in the region, and to understand that most of the countries in the region share our foreign policy, friends to all, enemies to none. So let us put that in practice.
Yes, absolutely. And if you were to win government, Mr. Kilnarea Jr., in the future, what would your position be on relations with China and Taiwan?
Yeah, well, I think when it comes to that, you know, Solomon Islands has already adopted the One China policy. So that is a policy that recognizes already China's claim over Taiwan, but at the same time don't necessarily endorse it. That is their claim. At the same time, Taiwan has offices even in Pacific Island countries. Our two big Melanesian brothers, Papua New Guinea and Fiji, have Taiwan offices there. You know, I think they are called other names, like trade and cultural offices. But the fact that they are also already involved in the Pacific is something that we should also respect. China is definitely a power in the world and in the Pacific. I don't think that's going to change. You know, that's already there. But at the same time, we should also allow and make space for other partners, including Taiwan, who might want to also contribute to our development as well and work together with us. You know, they continue to work with countries in the PIF members. They continue to work with the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat. You know, they provide scholarships still for all members of the forum, regardless of whether you recognize them or not. They support programs in the Pacific Island Forum Secretariat, including the Blue Pacific. They're engaging already, so it doesn't make sense when we need all hands on deck. You know, if there are countries, partners who want to continue to help support Pacific, help support Solomon Islands, then we should continue to work with them rather than shut them out.
Indeed, and Nook, we thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it, and thank you for your insights on the ongoing uncertainty around Taiwan's attendance.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas. That was Solomon Islands opposition MP Peter Kenny-Lorea Jr.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Talo Falava and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Pacific leaders are celebrating a legal victory, with the world's highest court saying states that fail to deal with climate change could be subjected to reparations. The advisory opinion by the International Court of Justice has been hailed as a landmark, but it could have serious implications on Pacific nations' relations with Australia. The ABC's Lucy Cooper with more.
We are very grateful. We still have to study the ruling or whatever it was called, but we are glad that they listened to the cry for help or for understanding from the leaders of the Pacific.
That's Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rabuka, reacting to the news overnight from The Hague, where the International Court of Justice declared that countries failing to tackle climate change risk breaking international law.
We are the least contributors, but the most affected by climate change. So it is a world recognized obligation on the more powerful to look after those without power like us.
In its non-binding opinion, which runs to more than 500 pages, the ICJ said a clean, healthy and stable environment is a human right.
It is not really a judgment as such that people should obey, but it is an indication that the world is listening.
It's been years in the making. The case began in 2019 when a group of Pacific Islander law students in Vanuatu decided to seek the ICJ's opinion on the legal obligations of states to prevent climate change and the consequences for them if they failed. 16-year-old Vipaya Mele Trieffs is the Save the Children Vanuatu Next Gen Youth Ambassador. Speaking on the decision, she says it was a positive outcome for all young people in the Pacific.
We see the effects of climate change in all aspects of our lives as young people in the Pacific who are disproportionately affected by climate change. And I know that this advisory opinion will pave the way for justice and for a safer future for all youth and for our future generations as well.
Vanuatu's government supported the students' cause and provided diplomatic support, rallying a global coalition that succeeded in convincing the UN General Assembly to refer the case to the ICJ in 2023. Vanuatu's Special Envoy on Climate Change, Ralph Reganvanu, said the court's decision was a landmark milestone.
We can say that there is now, from the highest court of the United Nations, in fact the world's highest court, the ICJ, very clear directives. There is an obligation on all states to not cause harm to their neighbours in the spirit of international cooperation.
Mr. Reganvanu has not ruled out launching litigation against large polluting countries, including Australia, in the wake of the findings.
Australia is committing internationally wrongful acts because it is sponsoring, it is subsidising fossil fuel production and excessive emissions. And so it needs to align itself with the advisory opinion and cease this conduct that is contributing to emissions and start making reparations.
This decision comes as Australia continues its bid to host the next COP meeting alongside the Pacific. Mr. Reganvanu says he wants to see action from Australia before then.
If the COP is being touted as a Pacific COP, the Pacific needs to be co-leading, but also we expect Australia to deal with the fossil fuel problem it has, to stop the production and subsidisation of fossil fuels, and to start phasing out, as we agreed to at the previous COP, that there will be a phasing down of fossil fuel production.
The Australian government has responded carefully to the International Court of Justice's ruling, with a government spokesperson saying while it was proud to join the Pacific in co-sponsoring the Vanuatu-led initiative, it would carefully consider the findings, and that the unprecedented participation by other countries in the ICJ proceedings reflects that we're not alone in recognising the challenges and opportunities of responding to climate change. change. ANU International Law Professor Donald Rothwell says the ruling was historic.
This is the first decision of the International Court on any climate-related matter. The fact that it's a unanimous decision gives this decision tremendous weight. The court has given enormous clarity to the extent and the breadth and the depth of international climate obligations. The advisory opinion really creates a pathway for those specially affected states to be able to use this determination by the court to engage in political and diplomatic negotiations with the major climate polluters to try to bring about a resolution of their core concerns. So that opens up a whole range of political and diplomatic options which could really be quite valuable, but those states are able to go into those negotiations armed with this very powerful advisory opinion.
Mr. Rothwell says this decision will open the door for litigation.
The next step is obviously to pursue litigation. So I don't see that as being an immediate response, but certainly it's something that all of these states can now keep in the back pocket. If these very specially affected climate impacted states do not achieve the sort of outcomes that they were hoping for at a political and diplomatic level.
Observers say it will reach far and wide in its impact.
We have a ruling today that will reverberate around the world and will echo through history.
That's Wesley Morgan, a research associate with the University of New South Wales Institute for Climate Risk and Response.
This is a planetary scale decision. Today is actually a day of reckoning for the fossil fuel industry and for governments that continue to allow fossil fuel companies to harm the Earth's climate system. It's hard to overstate how momentous this ruling is. The judgment or the advisory opinion from the Court of Justice will reverberate in parliaments, in courts, in boardrooms around the planet.
The case was the biggest the ICJ had handled, with judges poring over tens of thousands of pages of submissions from countries and organisations around the world, including Australia. The ICJ said climate change was an urgent and existential threat to humanity, and countries had a duty to cooperate on addressing it. Stephanie Stevens of Vanuatu said it was a milestone, particularly for women in her community.
Staffordshire planned the issue for climate change, planned the impact.
We have faced many problems because of climate change, lots of impacts. It's affected our lives. During normal times, we've worked hard walking to find water, to find food, to carry it back. And when you add the impact of climate change onto our lives, it's an even bigger problem for us because we're the ones looking after our household. When we heard the news, we were glad. We've got some big countries that create pollution. They can support small Pacific Island countries with money. They can also put more action in their own country to reduce pollution from factory or industry.
The decision has been touted as a turning point for the Pacific region. Reverend James Bhagwan, General Secretary of the Pacific Conference of Churches and leading climate justice advocate for Pacific Island communities, described it as a call to conscience.
Now we can really hold states accountable if they are not doing enough. And this can also be applied to companies and industries as well. Communities can take people to task, can take companies, can take countries to task. And I think also from our Pacific perspective, you know, our deep relationship with the Vanua, the Whenua, if a healthy environment is a human right, then rivers, forests, mountains, the ocean must be recognized as rights-bearing entities.
He applauded the work of the Pacific Islander law students who came up with the idea of seeking an advisory opinion on climate change.
Their work from a classroom in Vanuatu to the world's highest court is a real statement, not only to the Pacific Island states, but to Pacific Island young people making a difference. These are people who have no choice but to act to protect their future.
Looking forward, the ICJ's decision means nations now have an obligation under international law to prevent climate change, and they may be liable to pay compensation if they fail to do so. It's an outcome Parlin Abraham Phillip, the chairman of the Vanuatu Climate Action Network, is keen to see implemented.
As part of the work that the community or the members within the Vanuatu Climate Action Network are doing is to get compensation, mostly looking at loss and damage funds, just to ensure that we ourselves recover from most of the contributing factors from the effects of climate change. And we are demanding climate justice.
That was the ABC's Lucy Cooper with that report.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Hafa Adai and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanuliong here in Solomon Islands. Polling in Papua New Guinea's Boggera Paella district has been completed peacefully, despite the hijacking of ballot boxes and the destruction of key bridges in the area. More than 400 military personnel were deployed to the district to help stage a by-election. As the ABC's reporter in Papua New Guinea, Belinda Cora, reports, polling was successfully completed under the watchful eye of security forces.
Some 2 years after the death of their local MP, the people of Boggera Paella district have finally held their long-awaited by-election. The election takes place in the midst of a lawlessness crisis in Enga province. Because of this, armed soldiers have been brought in from outside the province to provide security. Elizabeth Iarume, a businesswoman in Boggera, says she's relieved to have the military on the ground for the election.
The general feeling is 100% plus. The people really wanted extra manpower to be on the ground before the polling because with the background of knowing that the fight, the warlords from different tribes, they just erupt anytime when you don't expect. So going to the polling, it might lead to some of the conflicts like this. So they are very happy about having and receiving this disciplinary process on the ground right now. So we are very thankful that at least they are here to contain the situation as well as the polling day will be safe as well.
The elections have been peaceful, but two bridges were destroyed and 8 ballot boxes hijacked by what the police is describing as a known terrorist group. Provincial Police Commander for Enga Province, Freddy Akasa, says those responsible will be dealt with by the law.
The act of destruction of the two bridges is criminal in nature. You're suffocating business. It's a crime against the state and its people. And those perpetrators, we know who you are, especially you leaders who have raised your hands to contest in this by-election, who are responsible for this. In one way or another, you have caused it or you have done it. You will all be held responsible.
Commander Yakasa says it's a big operation, keeping polling sites safe and secure for voters.
We had security issues here, but we are managing it. We've got about 300 to 400 strong security personnel here in Boggera, and we are managing situations here, and we have made decisions here and there in consideration of security and changing polling sites, so on and so forth, but at least still giving a fair chance to the people to cast their votes.
Despite the destruction of the bridges, Police Commander Fred Yakasa says the by-election has so far been peaceful and under control.
Why we are doing it in the last 4 days is because of many security issues on the ground. And the only smart way to do is to spread it out a bit, and then we manage by beefing up security, and we can do it on one central location. We can take control of the situation. It's the reason why we're doing all this, and I'd like to thank everyone for your cooperation so far. I thank all my security personnel, plus our ACP, Acting ACP Joseph Tondop, the commander who's actually controlling these by-elections here, and of course OC for the defence major, James Kent, and all men and women for a good job well done, and of course electoral officials as well, and of course the good people of Boggera who are also cooperating with us.
Provincial Police Commander for Enga Province, Freddy Akasa, ending that report from Belinda Cora. In Fiji, the National Geographic Pristine Seas Expedition has set sail to study the health of Fiji's oceans. The expedition, which began its Fiji expedition earlier this year, aims to support Fiji in achieving its ambitious goal of protecting 30% of its ocean by 2030. Local scientists and international researchers are using state-of-the-art submersibles and media tools to gather scientific data to help Fiji's government create policies to protect its ocean resources. The ABC's Fiji reporter, Lithe Movono, will be the first Pacific journalist to join the expedition in 3 weeks. She was on the vessel, the Argo, on Monday and files this report.
For the first time, the deepest parts of Fiji's oceans will be explored closely, and images will be captured as the National Geographic Pristine Seas Expedition sails through the country. Launched in Suva on Monday, the expedition's Fiji leg will use advanced technology to investigate some of Fiji's important and largely unexplored ocean areas. A team of international and Fijian scientists on board will gather data to help Fiji's government develop long-term ocean protection strategies. Also present is young conservation scientist Janice Tanga. She's a chief and also what's known locally as Ngonendau, or traditional custodian of the ocean.
This is a dream come true, I would say, as a scientist, an aspiring scientist. And also, I would say it's a bit of a big task ahead, because there's a lot of work that needed to be done. And we hope that from this expedition, we can help inspire other people that would like to move in this platform.
A coral reef ecologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society, Janice is on board the Argo now to join what will be one of the largest research dives of Kandavu in Fiji's south.
As a female, a Fijian female, I think this is one of our tambu areas. And I hope that me being in this field will inspire other women out there that you can do anything. It's gender balance. I know a lot of people here have a big part of the ocean, is a big part of them. And then this is something that you can do. You can help solve problems that are needed for our communities and the people that are dependent on them. For me, it's learning as much as about the protocols, learning about the tools that are there that we can help inform decision makers, and also inspire, just to help build the capacity of young researchers that are out there.
Dr. Sivendra Michael, a conservationist who is also permanent secretary for Fiji's Ministry of Environment and Climate Change, campaigned National Geographic's policy directors in 2023 to consider Fiji. He explained the importance of the research in shaping the country's marine protection policies.
Ocean protection is an investment in prosperity for the Fijian people. Healthy reefs and mangroves buffer our coast from storms, sustain inshore fisheries, and attract visitors to world-class dive sites. Offshore reserves can act as nurseries for tuna stocks that support our domestic longline fleet. The data gaps is mostly on, as I said, deep sea. So below a certain level, we don't have the necessary equipment to be able to map those and understand those sea mounts and so forth. And so understanding all of that and mapping it all out is really important. And for me, the biggest thing is to the multiple uses of the ocean space to answer to them. The data is going to be analyzed so that it's not going to be for the industry. It's going to be for government's decision making to be able to make informed decisions.
Afa Sokimi is Pacific Regional Director at Blue Prosperity Fiji, the local NGO that the National Geographic Pristine Seas Expedition has partnered with for its Fiji leg. He said the voyage boosts local capacity in marine science, ensuring that Fijian scientists take the lead in the country's ocean protection efforts.
A lot of the decisions we need to make need to be backed up by science. And we've not always had the opportunity to have expeditions of this caliber take place in Fiji. So one of the things that we really celebrate is the skills dividend that these expeditions have helped bring to Fiji. It's important that our science is led by our own people. It's been a pleasure for me to see a lot of our young researchers being engaged in this process, especially when it comes to the planning, the actual research, the post-research analysis, the report compilation and all of that. And I can't stress how important partnership is, because to be able to effectively address the challenges that we are facing as a country, as a region, we can't do it alone. We need to work together, and we need to find ways to work together effectively, because only together are we able to then carry the massive load that we all have to bear.
As the Pristine Seas team continues its deep sea exploration, they're also focusing on engaging local communities. Ryan Jenkinson, Expeditions Director for Pristine Seas, said that while scientific data is critical, the true impact of the expedition will come from ensuring that local voices are heard and that conservation efforts are led by the people most affected.
In some places, the storytelling in the media is the primary thing that drives change and marine spatial planning. In other places that we've been, there's almost no data whatsoever. So it's like the first time they've even seen information about what's in the ocean from a scientific perspective. It's the story of the people and their relationship with the ocean that move the needle on them changing the areas that they protect to be more effective long-term for the community. So the main message is it's really different, and it's community-driven and it's country-driven.
That was Arthur Sokimi, the Pacific Regional Director at Blue Prosperity Fiji, ending that report from Lethe Movono in Fiji.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Koreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Sounds of the victory parade here in the Solomon Islands capital of Honiara after the country's women's football team brought home the prestigious OFC Nations Cup. Their 3-2 win against the PNG Lakatois in Suva last week marked their very first time to make the finals of the Nations Cup. I caught up with the Solomon Islands captain, Eileen Peggy, who tells me it's her hope that this win is proof that investment in locally based players can make for victories.
Just trust in teamwork and hard work in the team is great. It's the game plan that we have, and being the leader, I have to really work extra hard for my team. So my assist was a result of my team's hard work throughout the game and the trust they have for each other and the teamwork that helps us to win the final. So I have to step up and, you know, help my team and, you know, go extra hard. And yeah, I'm just proud of that assist and for Jamil to scoring the winning goal for the team.
Yes, so Eileen, congratulations on that win, coming back home with the trophy. You know, if you're on the socials, you won't miss this photo of yourself holding the trophy in one hand. You have flowers garlanded on you, and you have this massive smile on your face. Take us through the emotions and feeling.
I can't explain how we felt that day. It's just all tears of joy, you know, like looking, coming back and see our families and the supporters. It's just emotionally, but, you know, proud. But it's just all tears of joy, and we're just so happy, and, you know, bringing back the cup, the title, and seeing everyone just, you know, coming out in numbers and all in green and yellow and blue. Just all tears of joy. We're just so happy. And
Eileen, football in Solomon Islands is male-dominated, and that we've seen over the years. But how does this win from the women's football team set you and the team as well for more opportunities?
Yeah, this has placed us in a position where women's football is now recognized, not in the Solomon, but like in the ocean. And with that, women's football in the country should be like given the priority, even to, you know, when we're like outside and like hearing in the news, like the updates, like the other teams have like overseas based players, and I think it's important to invest in our local talented girls in our region only. I'm not saying that we should always get the overseas based players, but I think there's more talented and there's more talented players in our own background.
With the win and the title back to Solomon Islands, for yourself, Eileen, where to now? Where does your football journey or football career take you?
For me right now, I'm just concentrating on my club, Hens and Eels here, and the Solomon SWPL here, the league B, and maybe signing obviously contract maybe later soon. So yeah, I think, and maybe retire. It's not getting any younger, so yeah.
And what would be your message to young girls here in the country and across the Pacific as well?
Yeah, it took me 13 years in my career to become like being a champion, the Oceania champion. So for me, I think it's patience and keep believing in yourself when you face challenges. Don't give up.
That was the winning captain of the Solomon Islands women's football team, Eileen Peggy, speaking to me there about what this historical win means for women's football development. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat, recapping our top story, Fijian-born recording artist and Pacific music legend George Fiji Veikoso has died at the age of 55 in Suva.
And I'm really sad. I mean, he's the biggest artist ever came out of Fiji and the Pacific.
Chair of the Fiji Performing Rights Association, Laisa Vulakoro, speaking there. Well, we'll be back at the same time Monday. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Agi Tupo. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because up next is news and coming up after that is Nigeria Daily. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong. Have a great day. Tagyo baitasiana.
Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.